All right. Well, we are in 2 Samuel chapter 14. I'm going to ask you to join me there in a few moments. Before that, we'll kind of set up our scene. But first, I want to say thanks for being here. It's not a nice night out there. The weather's rough. It has been on me from the time I hit Ocala on up here. It's been wet. But I want to tell you something. That's encouraging. Some of y'all, when I came in, said, "Oh, don't hug me. I'm all wet. I'm all wet." I want to tell you, the devil hates wet Christians because we don't burn well. So get wet. Get out there and get wet. Just revel in it because you won't burn well. All right? Thanks for being here. Second time for us to be together in the Old Testament. And we'll be there, Lord allowing, one more time next week back in the Old Testament. There isn't really any major connection between these people, except that they're lesser-known characters. They're not the people that we tend to look at, but I think there's a lot we can learn from them. And I want to tell you, before we begin the lesson tonight, one more thing. You know, I've been to art galleries, and I like art, and sometimes I can go and read about a portrait, and it has meaning. If the person in the portrait has their hand on a sword and perhaps another hand and it's holding a dove, that might have some meaning for us. And we try to decipher, what does all that mean? And is there value in that for us? If you were to look at the Statue of Liberty, you would learn some things by looking at how that is constructed and what's prominent and what's not in the Statue of Liberty. But there are other pictures and paintings that are just to be looked at for just the beauty that they offer, just to revel in it. A gorgeous picture of a tree in full bloom or in the throes of autumn and it's bright gold. And you're not saying, well, I wonder what those leaves mean and why are some of them on the ground and why does that branch hang over? You just revel in it. And I want to tell you tonight, at the end of the lesson, there's not going to be much by way of application for us. There will be, but not a lot. But what I hope there will be for you is what there is for me in this story. Just to revel in the picture that is painted for us. So let's begin. It's 1 Samuel chapter 14 you're going to be in, but I'm going back to chapter 12 because the story actually starts there. The story is that of David in chapter 11 when he commits his horrible sin with Bathsheba. And then in chapter 12, Nathan comes to him, confronts him with this story about the man who has the little ewe lamb. And David gets caught up in the story and wrought at the man. He deserves to die. And Nathan says, "You're the man." And David recognizes it. The scales fall from his eyes and he is aware, "Yeah, I am." And he's very penitent about that. But God says a couple of things to him. "You may be penitent, but let me tell you what's going to happen. The child that Bathsheba has by you, that child's not going to live. No way." And then in verses 10 and 11, Nathan says, "I want to tell you something else. There is going to be great turmoil in your house, and some of the people in your house are going to rise up against you. And somebody is going to take your wives. And what you did in secret with Bathsheba, that person is going to do in public with your wives. So just steel yourself for a really rough period." And then you come to chapter 13, and it all starts happening. He's got a son named Amnon, and Amnon is in love with his half-sister, Tamar. And Tamar loves Amnon. They have a relationship going. And you and I might say, "Ew, that's nasty." They're not fully brother and sister. They're half brother and sister. Same father, different mothers. And in this period of time, not unlike some periods of the English royalty or the French royalty. They intermarry. And so Amnon is sexually driven. Tamar is morally driven. He says, let's get together. And she says, no, do this honorably. Let's get married. Ask my father. He'll give me to you. But Tamar, on the advice of his, quote, air quotes, best friend, because Jonadab is no best friend to him to give this advice. He says, oh, we can set this up and you can take her. It's a nasty story. It's very ugly. He takes Tamar by force, and then she is distraught. She will pretty much drop out of the picture, a woman in disgrace. But David does nothing about it with Amnon. The word is out. The kingdom knows. But David just can't bring himself to punish his son. Enter Absalom. If Amnon made a big mistake, it was that he took the full sister of Absalom. And Absalom is not going to take that like his father. So Absalom calls together, it's all in chapter 13. Absalom calls together all the sons of David. Hey, big party, my place. Every son of David is invited, and they all come. I find it really interesting that it's stated they all come on donkeys. Not big horses, donkeys. And while they are all gathered feasting, Absalom has told his men, the guys that rally to him, when I give the word, you kill Amnon. He's not going to do this in private. This is not Joab killing Abner. You know, he killed Abner. He said, hey, Abner, I got a message for you. Come over here in this little alcove. Come here. I got something to tell you. Pulls him in the alcove and he slips a knife into him, leaves him there. No, Absalom's going to do this with style. And so when he gives the word, his men jump on Amnon and kill him. Right there in the presence of all the sons of David, who, it says, jumped on their donkeys and rode in haste. They fled in haste. Now, I got to tell you, I would love to see somebody fleeing on a donkey. Now, I don't know much about them, and some of you may come to me and say, donkeys are really fast. But I know this, I've never seen donkey races. And I've watched donkeys, and I rode one once. And they do not run well. Whereas a horse does the tick-a-doom, tick-a-doom, tick-a-doom. A donkey goes tick, 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 tick. So I can see these heads bouncing all the way as they are fleeing from Absalom. They are fleeing because they thought he's going to kill us all. And that's a word that gets back to David. Absalom has killed all of your sons. And David falls on the floor. He is weeping profusely. He's lost everybody. He's lost Amnon to Absalom. And now Absalom's killed all the others. And that means Absalom's either got to flee or be killed. So David will lose all of his male progeny. All of them. And David's distraught. And then Jonadab, the friend of Amnon, comes to David and says, no, the story's wrong. They're not all dead. Only Amnon is dead. Only Amnon. And then the watchman on the wall looks, and here he sees coming, again, what I'd love to see, this massive retinue of donkeys rushing toward the palace for safety. And all the sons of David come into the palace and collapse in tears. They're weeping profusely. Now, they're either weeping for relief, it could have been us, or they're weeping out of fear, we thought we were going to die, or they're weeping because they watched the brutal murder of their brother. And then we come now to the very end of chapter 13 and this statement. The heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. Now, that doesn't mean David was fine with Amnon being dead. But David recognized there's nothing I can do for him. He's dead. So I'm okay. I can't do anything about that. But Absalom, Absalom. This great, beautiful prince of Israel with a heart for vengeance that David should have had but didn't, with the courage David should have had but didn't. Absalom is the Goel, the kinsman redeemer of his sister. But now he's gone. He's in Geshur. He's banished. He can't come home. And he will stay there, according to verse 38, 3 years. So for 3 years, David looks at the mental picture of Absalom and sighs. And our story opens in chapter 14. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. There's Joab. Cue the hero music. Joab is going to try to make this better. He sees his king sighing, distraught, saddened. 3 years now without his son. And Joab says, I'm going to solve this. So it says he sent to Tekoa. By the way, Tekoa, that's Tekoa, not Tacoma. It's not in Washington or anywhere nearby, and she doesn't have a truck. It's Tekoa. And that is the area where Joab is from. So I'm gonna make some assumptions that aren't critical to the story, but my guess is this is a famous woman. He knows her. He doesn't just pick somebody randomly, especially when you see her skills in communication. He knew about this woman and knew she could be the woman to pull this off. So it says he sent to Tekoa and he brought a wise woman from there. The wise woman of Tekoa. And he said to her, pretend to be a mourner. Now, that's the way the New American Standard renders it. But literally what he says is, I want you to force mourning. I think it's possible that the story that she tells is really true. But he wants her to tell it in such a way that it will become a vehicle by which he, Joab, can effect change in David. He has learned well from Nathan. So he tells this woman, here's the story. Let's put this together. The wording is critical. David can't suspect that there's an ulterior motive to this story when we tell it. Force the mourning. Put on mourning garments now. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who's been mourning for the dead many days. And then go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Joab put the words in her mouth. So here's a woman who's going to carefully tell David, every word is important. She can't reveal too much too early. They rehearse it, and she's finally ready. So now we pick up the story. She comes. She spoke to the king. She fell on her face to the ground. She prostrated herself and said, help, O king. And the king said, what's your trouble? And she answered, truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead. Your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them. So one struck the other and killed him. And now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant. And they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Thus, they will extinguish my coal which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Okay, pause there. I want you to think about what she has set up. The wording is critical. I want to read this for you again, and you tell me, does this sound really familiar to you? I had two sons, and they went out into the field together, and they fought, and one prevailed over the other and killed him. And now everybody wants to kill my son. You've heard that story. It's in Genesis chapter 4. It's Cain and Abel. It's the same story. Two sons. It's even constructed the same way. Went out into a field. This didn't happen in the tent. This didn't happen in the woods. This happened out in the field. That's exactly the story of Genesis. And then you say, well, what about everybody wanting to kill him? You remember what Cain said? My punishment is too great. Wherever I go, man will want to kill me. Everybody will want to kill me. And what prevented that from happening? God put a sign on him. Some kind of mark that protected Cain from men. Keep that, log that, we're coming back to it. So listen, I love this woman's wording. This, she is so eloquent. She doesn't say, and this means my family dies. She uses this word. She's the only one to really talk about her heritage this way. Thus, they will extinguish my coal. Why does she use that word? Well, what does a coal bring? Life, warmth, heat. Protection. You build a fire at night when you're in the woods. Why? Well, it'll protect us. They are going to leave me defenseless, David. Defenseless. I'll have nothing. They're going to extinguish my coal. And my husband, who's dead, will have neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. So verse 8, the king says, go to your house, I'll give orders concerning you. And she responds, O my lord the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. Now, let me explain what's happening here. David first says, go back home, I'll deliberate and make some decision on this. I will give a judgment on this. And then her response is this. Well, yeah, you're not under the gun. The iniquity is not on you. You're guiltless. You're not going to be hurt by this. But I can't wait for a decision. The iniquity is on me and my household. I need a decision on this. I can't wait for judgment. And he responds in verse 10, well, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me. He'll not touch you anymore. That's David's response. Hey, don't worry about it. If somebody threatens you or your son, send them to me. He'll not touch you. I'm going to make a decision. I haven't decided yet, but I will. But I will take care of it. And then she says, please, please let the king remember the Lord your God. Remember, God said, the avenger of blood doesn't rest until he has killed the one in his family who's been wronged. Please let the king remember the Lord your God so that the avenger of blood will not continue to destroy. Otherwise, they'll destroy my son. And then he says, because here's what she's wanting. She wants this conclusion. As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Now, I have a sense that David went from a magnanimous pose before this woman to a bit of irritation. Here are the three stages. Stage one, they're going to extinguish my coal. Look, go back home. Let me think about it. I'll give you a decision. She says, no, the iniquity is on my house. They're going to kill me. I can't wait for a decision. He says, look, if somebody threatens your son, send them to me. I'll tell them to leave you alone till I make a decision. And she says the third time, the avenger of blood will come. And now he says, okay, he doesn't die. I'll spare him. And then she gives the reason for the story. You know, I'll pause here and say something. It's only been 3 years ago that David got suckered in by a story. Nathan came to him when he was unaware of his sin. He had not really cataloged his sin as he should have. He did not say about his sin what God said about his sin. And Nathan comes and says, oh, there was a man with a little ewe lamb. And there was another man and he had abundant sheep. But when it came time for a feast, he took the one man's ewe lamb and he sacrificed it and he gave it to his people. That little ewe lamb that man named and slept with and coddled and nurtured. It was his pet. It was as if it was his child. And David gets wrought. And he says to Nathan, as sure as I'm the king, that man should die. And then Nathan says, you're the guy. And David says, I am. God forgive me. Now here he is 3 years later. And a woman comes to him and says, I have a story. And I'll tell you, if I were David, I'd like to think, I said, I don't do stories. I got caught by those before. I don't do stories. But when he says, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground, David's dismissing her. Okay, it's done. Your son has my protection. And the woman says, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord, the king. And if I were David, I'd have gotten a bad feeling about that. I have one more thing I need to tell you. Listen to her words. Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty in that the king does not bring back his banished one. Here's what she says. You have jeopardized the entire kingdom. You're on hold mentally. And your son, who ought to be the next king because he is the next in line in age, Absalom is away. If something happened to you, the kingdom would go into turmoil. Why will you do this to your people? And you tell me that I can protect my son who killed his brother, but you won't protect your son who has killed his brother. That's the point. Why will you not bring back this your banished one? And then I want to tell you something. I think verse 14 is perhaps the most beautiful, picturesque description of the good news of God's salvation to be found anywhere in the Scriptures. For we will surely die. And we're like water spilled on the ground which cannot be gathered up again. Listen to our point. We're all wasted. We're going to die. And our lives, if we live them for ourselves and live them like most of us live them, we're going to be like water poured out on the ground. Useless. We're going to die wasteful in our lives. But God does not take away life. That's not God's will, to pour us out on the ground like wasted water. But He plans ways so that the banished ones will not be cast from Him. Folks, I'm going to tell you, that is one beautiful statement. Because what you have here in this one sentence is one of the best summaries of the entire Bible of the story of mankind. That the banished ones will not die. God has plans for them. What is a banished person? It's a person who's sent out, sent away. Not allowed to come back. They're sent away. I want you to think about how many times the Bible depicts sinners who leave God in terms of banishment. Go to Genesis 3. Adam and Eve, what happened to them? Sent out of the garden. Out, out, out. Go, 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 go. You can't stay here. You're banished. You can't return here. You're banished. Chapter 4 of Genesis. Cain kills Abel. What happens to him? He went out. That's the very word used. He went out. East of Eden. Away. Away. When they sin, they go away. Move forward in the story. When Jacob deceives his father, what does he have to do? Go away. He has to leave home. And we may paint it in idyllic terms of a stone for a pillow and seeing angels ascending and descending, but you need to know that at the time that happened, Jacob was one lonely, banished young man. Banished. In the New Testament, what happens to the prodigal when his heart turns against his father? He goes out. He goes away. And then take it even on simpler terms. Do you remember when Peter denied the Lord the first time? He stayed at the fire. And he denied him the second time, and he stayed at the fire. And he denied him the third time, and he would have stayed at the fire, but Luke tells us, and at that moment, the rooster crowed, and Jesus looked at him, and you remember the very wording? You remember it? And he went out and wept bitterly. Went out. Same word. Went out, went away. And give you one more. When Judas brought the money and threw it at the feet of the priests, the text says he, what? Went out and hung himself. The story of mankind is always that we choose to follow a path that is away from God. We choose to go out. We choose to go away. That's the very nature of sin, to go away from God, to hide ourselves from God. And then in our banishment because of what we've done, we do just what Absalom did. We flee. The gospel is a message for banished sinners. The gospel is not a message for angels. I have to tell you, that statement has always intrigued me, you know, this angels long to look into this message. I'll tell you why. It's because the angels cannot comprehend the concept of banishment. Jesus said of them, they always behold my Father's face. They don't go out. They don't go away. Those angels of God, with the exception of that handful that rebelled against him back in Genesis chapter 6, with the exception of those, the angels are always in the presence of God. They don't go away. They don't go out. Oh, I'm not saying they don't leave God's company at times, but their hearts are never of a mind to go away because they serve him night and day. So the gospel has no meaning for them. And God has no plans for them. But I am so thankful that God has plans for Ralph Walker, the banished. Because I chose to leave God. I chose to live my life my way. And God had plans for me. So here's what happens in the story. David does bring Absalom back. He says to Joab, go get him. I find that interesting. You go get him and bring him back. And when God had plans for us, what did he do? He told his right-hand man, you go get them. Go talk to them. Go bring them back. And so Romans 5 says, but God demonstrated his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, now paraphrase, while we were yet banished, Christ died for the banished ones. God plans to bring the banished ones home, to let them revel in his company again. Now, David's story doesn't end up quite that nicely. He doesn't do for Absalom what he should have done. Absalom can come back to Israel, but he can't come to David. I can't see him. David has trouble balancing justice and mercy. It's a difficulty for him. So Absalom seethes. He just gets more and more irascible and difficult. And that's when he starts plotting the overthrow of his father. And it will be through all those events that Absalom himself will take his father's concubines and go into them in a tent on the roof of the palace, and show all Israel that everything that was his father's now belongs to Absalom the king. And Absalom will die at the hands of Joab. And David will mourn and recognize again the punishment God had for him. All this works together for God's plans. But unlike Absalom, we need to come fully home to where the God who has plans for the banished ones awaits with open arms. And that's the story of the woman of Tekoa. Let's pray together. Lord, we who have been banished by our rebellious hearts are so grateful that you had a plan to bring us home through Jesus our Lord. Thank you for his persistence. Thank you for his consistency. Thank you for his heart and yours and that of the Spirit that made it possible for us to return to your company, to your house, to your arms. Thank you in Jesus Christ. Amen.